Today on Reader's Corner, Deborah Campbell, author of A Disappearance in Damascus, Friendship and Survival in the Shadow of War. Hello and welcome to Reader's Corner. I'm Marcia Franklin with Idaho Public Television, filling in for Bob Kustra. The overthrow of Saddam Hussein and his regime in 2003 threw Iraq into turmoil. Refugees streamed out of the country, with more than a million fleeing to Syria. In 2007, journalist Deborah Campbell traveled to Damascus to report on the refugees' lives in exile and how the crisis was affecting Syria. While there, she met Ahlam al-Jabouri, a refugee also known to journalists as a fixer, someone who provides media with dependable information and contacts, as well as helping them stay safe. Ahlam and Deborah started working together on stories. But when al-Jabouri was taken from her apartment right in front of Campbell, a different tale emerged, one Campbell chronicles in her book, A Disappearance in Damascus. It's both a portrait of a determined and brave woman and a thriller about Campbell's attempts to find and release her. Deborah Campbell is an award-winning immersive journalist who's reported from around the world, including Syria, Iran, Palestine, Cuba, and Russia. Her writing has appeared in Harper's, The Economist, and The Guardian, among other periodicals, and she's the recipient of three National Magazine Awards for her foreign correspondence. She's an assistant professor at the University of Victoria in British Columbia. Deborah Campbell, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I mentioned in my introduction that you are what's called an immersive journalist, which doesn't mean you report underwater, although you've said it can feel like drowning journalism or thrashing around journalism. But explain to our listeners a little bit more about what immersive journalist is, as opposed to one that they might be more familiar with.
Well, a lot of the news journalism your listeners will know about is where a reporter comes in and maybe spends a short amount of time going directly after a story. And the work that I do tends to be going and trying to live among the people that I'm writing about. Might be a little bit closer to ethnography or anthropology. And what I'm doing in those weeks, months, sometimes even longer, is trying to look for clues to what is really going on and looking for small stories that will illuminate the larger story of history. So that involves me getting really close to communities, usually learning a little bit of the language so that I can get around. I had a bit of a background in classical Arabic and really living among people. So it's not the in-and-out journalism that we're more accustomed to.
And those phrases, drowning journalism or thrashing around journalism, I assume relate to the fact that you don't always know where the story is. You've got to thrash around a bit. You've got to accumulate a lot of stories and facts. And then that thread comes through. That story comes through eventually.
Exactly. I don't usually go in with a preconceived idea of what the story is going to be. I'm waiting for it to tell me. So that involves patience. Time. Sometimes it's also called slow journalism. So you're looking for quality and you're looking for some deeper pleasures in the story than daily news journalism. And the writing style is a lot different too. You described the book as being like a thriller, and some reviewers have said similar things, that it reads more like a novel. And that's what I'm looking for, and that requires actually really getting to know people, too, so they come alive on the page. And all of that, of course, takes a lot of time.
And related to that, you have a comment that I've read where you say, I think your books choose you, you don't choose them. And in this instance, you went to Syria, as I mentioned, to report on the plight of refugees. Your fixer, and we'll talk about her in a moment, Ahlam, disappeared. So all of a sudden, the story became something different, and out of it came this book. So it's almost like, as you say, the story and the book chose you.
Yes, very much.
You had
so.
To, but you had to be there for the duration, be friends with this woman to have this happen.
Exactly. And I have a theory that if you want to write about people and society. You need to spend time in it and experience at least a little bit of how people live. And in this case, of course, I experienced a lot more than I had bargained for. Mm.
Well, let's also talk about fixers. I think anyone, including me, who has been in a foreign country reporting or doing business in a country, you absolutely need what has come to be called a fixer colloquially, but is really a helper, somebody who knows the culture and can move around in it, can help you stay safe and introduce you to contacts. And through various people, you met Ahlam. And Ahlam was, I believe, 42 when you met her, an Iraqi refugee living in Syria, and had quite a different background than maybe other women of her age at that time. Describe Ahlam to us, what she looked like, and her personality.
Well, Ahlam was, a real force of nature, but she was tall for an Iraqi woman. She was attractive. She was very funny and witty. And I suppose what drew me to her was what a lot of people were drawn to: her charisma, her leadership qualities, and to an extent her fearlessness as well. But really, she had lived Iraqi history in a very interesting way. She was she grew up in a small village outside of Baghdad, right on the outskirts, and a Sunni village, and her father was the sheikh. About 500 people lived there, and she was the first girl in that village ever, the first to go to high school and the first male or female to graduate from university. And there was a lot of opposition in the village. It was a traditional farming village when her father allowed her to go to high school, because it was seen as a great break with tradition, and girls were supposed to tend to the orange trees and the date palms. And her father really fought for her. He said, "No one knows what the future holds." And he believed that education was a weapon and she might need it in the future. And it turned out she really did, because her education led her to learning English. And then in the 90s, she started to, this is when the economy of Iraq was in free fall under the sanctions, and people were literally starving. And her family began working as fixers for journalists. Originally, the Wall Street Journal was her first client, and later she began fixing for BBC, NPR, lots of places. And it also led her to, when the Americans, the soldiers arrived in her village, they were, I think, much like me, attracted to her leadership qualities. And she became a sort of go-between between the American soldiers and the needs of the village, which was in crisis in the early part of the war. And they eventually hired her as a civilian translator to work in a general information center, which she, being the person that she was, roughly took it over and turned it into a sort of town hall, solving all kinds of problems and also looking for missing persons, because people were disappearing regularly, either being arrested or kidnapped, murdered, and she became a key figure until she was eventually kidnapped by Al-Qaeda in Iraq.
For having worked for Americans, in part.
That's right. And she was kidnapped, she was beaten and held for a week, and her life was threatened. They saw her as a kind of Mata Hari figure, which she thought was hilarious. They accused her of having dyed her hair blonde, and I think they saw her as some really extraordinary spy when she was actually spending most of her time taking care of widows and orphans. And in the end, that's what got her out, because they called all the numbers on her phone and found out that they were largely linked to orphans and widows who were grateful to her for all she had done for them.
But a ransom was paid for her. As I recall, $50,000 or something like that.
A bulwark of the economy at that time was kidnapping.
And so she had to leave. I mean, she fled to Syria, yes.
That was the agreement, that she pay the ransom and leave the country forever.
And tried to come back, but that was too dangerous. So she finds herself in Syria. And continues her fixing business, like fixing problems for people.
She was a fixer in more ways than one.
Yeah, I was going to say, when I read your book, one thing that was illustrative was she wasn't just fixing problems for Western journalists or even journalists from the Middle East, but she was also trying to help fix problems of ordinary Iraqis, refugees who had come like her to Syria. And she didn't discriminate or distinguish whether somebody was Sunni or Shia. She just helped everybody.
Well, this is one of the things that stood out to me right away, because things were so divided inside Iraq and then in Syria, people still stayed in their camps, Sunni, Shia, Christian, other minorities, and she had really no truck with those divisions. And so people trusted her from all sects, and she was kind of like a one-woman NGO / mayor of the large community of Iraqis in her part of Damascus. And so that trust that came through the work that she did also made it possible for foreign correspondents to gain access to the people that were coming and going from her life, so that she would enable us to talk to them and have that trust built in.
And in your instance, I should back up a bit and say that you did not go in formally as a journalist. You went in as a professor, as an academic, which is also part of what you really do. But there was a decision that you made to not be seen as a journalist.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and that's something that I'd been doing for some years before that, because I've worked in different countries in the Middle East and also a bit in Latin America. And my experience is that when governments feel unstable, that the word journalist is a dirty word, and almost immediately you find yourself followed. You can have your sources watched. If you talk to someone and, you know, you leave and you go home, they may be there to face the consequences. And now, of course, they can easily look at your computer and listen to your phone. And so it becomes very difficult to do any work, and your freedom of movement can be restricted. So in my experience, it's better to go with an alibi and go undercover. Of course, you know, keeping that status as something that is verifiable, because I do teach at a university. So then you become innocuous. And unfortunately or unfortunately, no one's worried about professors. They don't think we do anything that's going to, you know, shake the centers of power. So this allowed me to answer the questions of what is she doing here whenever I was in a place. In a lot of places I went, there were no Westerners at all. And so I would stand out.
I'm Marcia Franklin, filling in for Bob Kustra. Today I'm speaking with Deborah Campbell, a journalist and the author of A Disappearance in Damascus. In the book, Campbell hunts for a colleague in Syria who was suddenly taken away by the secret police. Did you find, as I did when I traveled to Iran as a journalist, that it was actually an advantage to be a woman? In my case, I was able to interview both women and men, whereas sometimes men might be able to only interview other men.
Yes, this is something that's sometimes called being the third sex. When you're a Western woman, so the rules don't really apply to you about in conservative areas where women and men don't mix that much, they don't apply to you. And yet, for most male journalists in conservative areas, they never speak to women. So you read these books or these reports, and you're like, where are the women? They're not there, because those journalists or writers don't have access to them. So you have that, and you also are not considered, as a woman, you're not considered to be a threat in the same way that a Western male journalist, photographer might be perceived as a threat. And so you're invited into homes, you can stay with people, and people will talk to you. Sometimes you're a curiosity, so they'll talk to you as well. And the community feels a sense of, often I've found, a sense of protectiveness towards you. And so there's a lot, I think, more safety in some ways, which is ironic, because a lot of people consider it to be, they think it would obviously be the opposite. But I found my freedom of movement was much, much better than male journalists, and my access and so forth. So yes, I absolutely agree with you. It's been an advantage.
Let's go back to Ahlam. As we mentioned, she had been kidnapped in Baghdad. She had been tortured. She had even had a mild heart attack after she came out. But in Syria, she continued doing work that was quite dangerous. And she was brave, and then also I read in between the lines of your book that there was also kind of a sort of naivete, let, you know, nothing's going to happen to me. And she just kept plowing along, helping journalists, helping other Iraqis, no matter their religion.
Yeah, she, I would say there was definitely a recklessness to her and a sense that if something was the right thing to do, then that's what she was going to do, regardless of the threats. And of course, look, she had been living through, she was living through the Iraq War. There were 1,000 bodies a month on the streets of Baghdad in 2007, 2008, mostly civilians. And you were seeing so much death. And this is not even beginning to look at the civilians who were injured and incredible violence. So she was used to it, and there was no safety. So she just decided to do what she was going to do, and I admired it. But then I began to really worry about it. I wondered about her judgment at times, and I felt I take calculated risks. I mean, I definitely have taken my share of risks, but I have tried to think through them, and I was starting to have alarm bells going off.
And in fact, you had been working in stories together for quite a while, looking at the plight of refugees, and had grown to become friends. And you were in her apartment one day, and you were the witness to her all of a sudden being taken away by the secret police, by authorities in Syria. Mm-hmm. And that moment had to be a pivotal moment in your life for you to see that happen. I mean, she stayed calm, but you knew something was going on.
I mean, there was a part of me that must have been in denial about it too. But I remember that day so well. You know, I was living in her neighborhood at this point. I was right in the center of things, and I was definitely the only Westerner there. People would call me the professor as I walked down the street. I mean, the word had spread. And that morning, as I walked to her apartment in this dense, warren of a neighborhood, I felt something. I felt that feeling you have on the back of your neck when someone's looking at you intensely. And I saw a man standing next to a motorcycle. And then I thought, oh, you know, they always stare at me because I'm the only Westerner. I'm just being paranoid. And I went to her apartment, and I took out my notebook, as I always did. She always had all the news, too. She had news that nobody had, and with connections to Baghdad as well. And then there was a knock at the door, and something felt different. She went to the door, and she didn't, usually the person would come right inside, and she went outside and talked in the hallway. And I immediately started wondering, where am I going to hide my notebook? There's no place to hide it in here. I knew that there was something wrong. And then a man walks in the door, and he's short, he's got a little mustache, one of those people that looks like he's in uniform, even in civilian clothing. And I knew he was secret police. And we just stood there, all three of us. He hadn't expected that I was there, I guess. And finally he said to her in Arabic, he said, get rid of her. And she came to me, and she looked at me with the most still face, absolutely no expression, and that was so unlike her. And she said, go now. And I left, and I remember walking back to where I was staying in this little hostel, and just feeling the acid flush of adrenaline and wondering if I was being followed. And she thought it would only be a couple of hours because she'd been pulled in like a dozen times into the secret police headquarters in her neighborhood. And she didn't come back. And I got a call the next day from someone I knew who had introduced me to her, a Syrian journalist. And he, I later found out, also worked for police, but that's another story. He called me and he said, come to my office. And I said, no, I can't come right now. I'm busy, essentially, you know, in this nightmare. And he said, no, come now. Because, of course, you never talk on the phone. You never to discuss anything on the phone. So I went to his office, and he said, she's been arrested, and it's because of you. and they think you're CIA or Mossad. And I said, look, if I'm a spy, I'm going to pay myself better than this. And also, you know, everyone thinks you're CIA. It's just a kind of thing that happens if you're out in the field. But they usually think men are CIA, not women. And then he said, you need to get out of this neighborhood, but you cannot leave the country. Because if you do, they'll capture you at the border, and they'll think that you're fleeing, and you have something to hide. So then I was in this situation where, what now? And that's, you know, that's when I decided I was going to stay, and I was going to go underground, completely off the radar.
And you were going to look for your friend.
Yeah, and use my skills as a researcher, as a journalist, to track her down.
Now, you couldn't leave Syria easily, but you could have easily decided, I'm not going to put myself into this dangerous situation.
Yeah.
What was it about Ahlam and your relationship that made you want to work so hard? Because the rest of the book is about your search for her and your attempts to, we find out she's in a prison, to get her released. Why did you make that effort?
Well, you know, when you work with someone so intensely, and you've probably experienced this with some of the fixers you've worked with, or with photographers you've worked with, people that are at your side, and you have each other's back, and, you know, this, people in the military are like this, too. They have each other's back, and there's a sense of bonding that comes from that, and a sense that you owe each other. And I really felt that. I mean, she had opened so many doors for me, and opened doors in my mind as well. And I also respected the work that she was doing. You know, she was running a girls' school out of her apartment. She was this one-woman NGO, and she was, reckless. But she'd been through so much, and I really felt obliged to do everything I could to help her. And I also knew nobody else would. You know, although she was a fixer for all the big journalists, you know, most of them had gone home, and there wasn't much they could do outside the country, and the UN seemed to me kind of lackluster in terms of what they were willing to do for her. They knew her, too. She was known everywhere, and she was creating big problems for them, obviously, by being arrested. So I felt like, okay, this is something I can do, and I'm going to do it. It was a real sense of we were friends. It mattered.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest is Deborah Campbell, a journalist and the author of A Disappearance in Damascus, Friendship and Survival in the Shadow of War. And that doesn't mean it was easy or not scary. And I think that some of the best passages in your book describe your increasing paranoia about being followed, being tapped, being broken into. It was not easy at all and scary. And ultimately, you kept running into roadblocks, and you have these sentences in which you talk about how you kind of all of a sudden, with these roadblocks and this difficulty getting to her, realize the sense of powerlessness that the people there have because they encounter these kind of roadblocks in their life all the time. You say the sense of powerlessness that you had was humbling. It is how most of the world lives. So you were discovering, you know, on a day-to-day basis what people were dealing with, trying to track down their loved ones, trying to deal with grief.
Yes, and also fear, dealing with so much fear because you know this is real. It's not theoretical what can happen to you. And it changes how you experience reality. And I had never experienced what it was like to feel hunted, to feel like nothing could be trusted, no one could be trusted. And that is a reality for people living in war. And it affected my mind, and I was able to step back and observe my mind, but I was in it at the same time. And so in that sense, it was, you know, I was talking about immersive journalism, experiencing something of the people that you're writing about, and it definitely did that for me, and it was enlightening, if terrifying.
Now, at this point in the book, you have some writing choices. You have discovered that Ahlam is in prison. You did at least find that out. In the book, you go on to describe her time in prison, which as a reader, one realizes you probably wouldn't have been able to get that much detail unless you had actually talked to her, which you did. So whether it's a spoiler alert or not, Ahlam did live, but you had this choice of how to structure the book, and you chose to describe her time in prison at this point. Was that a writing challenge for you?
It was. Well, I did structure the book like a thriller, and of course, you're right, spoiler alert, I actually am able to get in, at least in a writerly way, inside the prison. So that's going to reveal something to the reader about, you know, how I got access to all that information. But I also felt like nobody has written from inside the women's prison in Damascus, and the material of what happened to her was fascinating. And so there was also that obligation to history as well as to literature.
Ultimately, Ahlam was released. You had tried every avenue that you could think of, the UN, other journalists, even some really interesting people that you had met along the way. And you didn't know if any of these things were working. You had to leave at a certain point. But ultimately, she was let go. Do you have a sense of why that might have happened, maybe because you were and others were about to go public with her plight?
I can piece a few things together, but it's still murky, as a lot of things that happen in police state situations are very murky. But it appears that the pressure and possibly finally the involvement of Amnesty International. She had worked as a fixer for Amnesty and Human Rights Watch as well, and so they knew her very well, and they became invested in her fate as well. And we were told by the UN not to go public at this point because it would just make things worse for her. Confirm, of course, that she was fixing for journalists when she'd been forbidden from doing so, etc. But Amnesty lost patience at a certain point, and good for them. They pushed the UN, and almost immediately after they said they were going to go public, she was released. So it appears, at least circumstantially, that that had something to do with it. It could also have been that after having her in and out of a couple of prisons and, you know, interrogating her, sometimes violently, that they may have gotten sick of her. You know, that does happen too. Or decided, you know, she's not a useful source. They pressured her to spy on journalists. So that's also possible. But I would say Amnesty's intervention and also the pressure of all of her friends. You know, she had so many friends around the world. She has friends, as I said, at the BBC, at NPR, all over the place. You know, most people don't have these kinds of friends and this kind of consistent pressure over time. And she was very fortunate.
Now, Ahlam and her children went to Chicago. Mm-hmm. And those descriptions of the prison that you got were, in fact, because you immediately went to Chicago and interviewed her at length and then kept going back to Chicago to interview her. She's the one who suggested that you write a book about this. So yeah. You're still close. She had some difficult times in Chicago, some PTSD that finally came to the fore. But she's had help, and she is a survivor. Tell us a little bit about Ahlam now.
Well, I just spoke to her on the phone about a month ago, and we talk about once a month, and she comes and visits me every summer for a few days, and I interviewed her hundreds of times, by the way, hundreds of hours, definitely, to reconstruct so much of what I didn't know. And but she did have a really hard time at first, like a lot of people do, landing in a new country. But I want to say this. The thing that has carried her through and the reason that she's doing so well right now is because of the Americans around her who, and again, she's very funny and charismatic and draws people to her. So it's made it a lot easier for her than for some refugees, but she has had these amazing American women who have, at the very beginning, some of them were, you know, writing to-do lists for her, making sure she went to the doctor, getting free dentistry, all these kinds of things, and helping her with job connections, and but also watching out for her mental health and arranging for her to see a therapist. And she didn't want to do that because she didn't want to open it all up. And especially some of the things that she had witnessed. And yet it ended up being really helpful. And her kids, too. You know, her daughter is now in, I guess, third year at University of Illinois, and she is in pre-med. She is a star student, but the reason that she did so well on her SATs and on, she got six offers to universities, three with full ride scholarships. The reason for that is because one of these friends of Ahlam said, you know, this is a, you've got a brilliant daughter, and I'm going to make sure she gets an SAT coach who helps her with all this stuff, and took her around to universities. And, you know, this would not necessarily happen for everyone. So that community is really makes an enormous difference in allowing people to adapt. And it does take time. You know, it doesn't happen overnight. It took about 5 years, really, for her to feel like Chicago is home. And she talks about Chicago being home. She loves Chicago, and Chicago loves her. Now she's working in refugee resettlement and helping other refugees.
That makes sense. I'm sure she's very good at it. Mm. Deborah, as we wrap up, you had a unique opportunity to see Syria before it fell into the chaos that it is in today. How are you feeling about Syria at this point? And do you have any optimism that the beautiful city that you were in, the people there, have any chance of regaining what they had?
You know, Damascus has been a crossroads of civilizations for thousands of years. It's one of the oldest continuously inhabited cities that we have in the world. And I was always so profoundly moved by being there. Everyone was there. The whole world was there. And you had, you know, nuns and priests and people in hijab and school kids in school uniforms and girls in shorts. And, you know, you could be who you were there. It was extremely multicultural, vibrant city. And so when the war started, I was devastated. And the feeling that it would have lost that that free spirit that I knew, old and new, the mix of religions and cultures. Now, it seems as if the day-to-day death and destruction has reached perhaps a stasis, that things have calmed down. It looks like Bashar al-Assad will be president for the foreseeable, and the last of the ISIS enclaves seems to be, well, they're under attack actually right now, but I don't know that the fighting is going to go away, and the devastation to the infrastructure and to historic sites, it's permanent. Whether things become stable, well, it seems like the world has moved on. It was an internationalized proxy war. You know, you had the Saudis in there with their arming the jihadists. You had the U.S. versus Russia. You had at least four layers I could think of. But now the world has sort of moved on, and it's looking like things may calm down, and I would like to hope, just the way Lebanon rebuilt after its 15-year civil war, that we will see the rebuilding of Syria. But I think it's still a long, long way off.
Yeah, and ironically, the Syrians who took in refugees are themselves refugees today.
They are, yeah. And you know, it's destabilized the whole world. Those Syrians that followed the paths of the Iraqis who were, I was chronicling the smugglers' routes when I was there, and they were moving Iraqis into Europe because they knew they couldn't, their country was destroyed. And those same smugglers, they pioneered the smuggling routes that have brought about a million, maybe 2 million refugees to Europe over the last few years. And the result has been to really empower dark sentiments, shall we say. And all of this is connected, you know. The Syrian war would not have happened without the Iraq war. It would not have become an internationalized proxy war. And you would not have had the level of death and destruction that caused so many millions of people to run for their lives. And so things have come around, in a sense, to affect political systems around the world.
Well, time is so short for these programs that I want to thank you, Deborah Campbell, for joining us today on Reader's Corner.
Great. Thanks so much.
Now, Ms. Campbell's book is called A Disappearance in Damascus. You'll want to look that up. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show was Eric Jones, with research and production by Joel Wayne. I'm Marcia Franklin, filling in for Bob Kustra, who returns next week. Please join him as he talks to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.